This podcast was originally live streamed on the Non Sequitur Show on YouTube. New episodes air weekdays, Monday through Friday, at 8 p.m. Eastern at youtube.com/nonsequiturshow. Make sure you never miss a live stream by visiting www.nonsecshow.com/schedule. For the latest news, polls and updates throughout the day, follow us on Twitter at nonsecshow or facebook.com/nonsecshow. That's NONSEQ show. If you'd like to get exclusive content, bi-weekly private hangouts with Kyle and Steve, backstage access to chat with guests after shows hosted on your channel and much more, become a Patreon saint of Non Sequitur. It ensures we continue to improve our show and brings you into the process at the same time. Visit patreon.com/nonsequitur today while the limited spots are still available.
The following podcast is intended for those who believe bold ideas are righteous, unique perspectives are gospel, and strong opinions are sacred. This is Non Sequitur. Never follow. And now, here are your hosts, Kyle Curtis and Steve McRae.
Hey, welcome everybody. As you guys may notice, we are having a little later than usual show. Usually we do it at 8 p.m. Eastern. Now it is 10 Eastern. One of the reasons for that is because of one, our guest tonight, and two, as you may notice, we don't have Kyle with us tonight. Kyle is on vacation still. He is snowed in, so I brought in a substitute, a more straight version of Kyle. His name is Jim Majors. You might know him from the Atheist Republic. He is the CEO of the Atheist Republic. He's also a friend. He's been awesome to our channel and into my personal channel as well. So I thought he would be a great co-host for this particular discussion because he's actually read the material here, and he's actually going to introduce the guest and kind of lead this discussion. I'm going to sit back and kind of be the guy that kind of just interjects when it comes to some of the topics, when it comes to presuppositionalism, theocracies, and that kind of nuanced stuff. But other than that, I'm just going to go straight into this. Welcome, buddy, to the Non Sequitur Show. And Jim, the floor is yours. Take it away.
Great. Well, first of all, thank you so much for being here. I'm happy to be here. So you are the author of Religious Right, The Greatest Threat to Democracy. And it's just basically exposes the religious right, what you call the religious rights agenda to replace our current democracy with a theocracy, a Christian-based theocracy. And it basically gets into who the power players are into this this organization, and their tactics and what they're trying to do to insert their beliefs into an otherwise secular society. And it's divided into six different parts, and it's written very much textbook style, and I really enjoyed it. Can you kind of go over real quick what the six different parts are and what they cover?
Oh, it's a good thing I got a copy of the book here. Okay, the six different parts. Section one is the critical issue, where I just go into separation of church and state and its importance. Section two is who are they and how do we get them? Section three is the resulting worldview of the religious right. Section four is the war is on, and it is a war in their opinion. Section five is the family mountain, which I go into what's called a seven mountains mandate. And so there's one whole section dedicated to the family mountain. And section six is the past and the future, taking a look at separation of church and state in antiquity and what to do in the future.
So the separation of church and state, it's clearly outlined in our Constitution. Everybody knows that we are clearly entitled to that as American citizens. So where do they get their justification for implementing their beliefs?
Well, they take a lot of history and twist it. There's the boats that came over, you know, with colonists. This was colonizing from England under the king's rule. And they want to say that because these were very religious people, that the United States was founded on religion. It wasn't. It was to be colonized. They had their loyalty to the king. There was no democracy in that at all. And most of them took the opportunity to go to a new world to escape that their particular brand of Christianity, their denomination, was not favored in the homeland, in England. And they were discriminated against either in their businesses or personally. Opportunities were limited because they weren't of the favored church that the state recognized and gave money to through the taxes and so forth.
Well, so I completely agree with you there. That's exactly what happened. But there were some people, especially apologists of the religious right, who would argue that that it's not freedom from the Christian God, that it is freedom of choice of a version of Christianity, since that it was, you know, the Puritans, the Quakers, and the different brands of Christianity, like you said.
Well, James Madison, one of our founding fathers, said that any power that can favor one particular version of Christianity can favor another shortly after. So there was no use in having a state sponsor. Thomas Jefferson didn't trust organized religion whatsoever, and his Bible it's called the Thomas Jefferson Bible, is where he stripped out the Old Testament and he stripped out anything that was supernatural in the New Testament. He did not believe in salvation or anything, and he put into the Virginia constitution that there was freedom, very specifically of religion. And when you go back, scholars have gone back, they can see where at the time the people were saying, including Thomas Jefferson and the others that were sponsoring his constitution and working to get it ratified for the state of Virginia, clearly said, we know that this also includes Mohammedans, which are what they called, you know, Islam or Islamists or Muslims at the time. So to say that our founding fathers never intended for any other religion except for Christianity is not only naive, thinking that our founders weren't intelligent enough to know about other religions and the nuances of the differences. Most of our founding fathers had some sort of belief structure, whether it was of a Christian brand or even a deist, or flat out didn't trust or believe in any. They recognized that citizens of this new country needed to have the freedom to worship as they would, not having anything dictated by the government, not having the government tax and take the money, allowing them to decide where their money would go. They knew full well that there were many different versions of Christianity, and they argued among themselves, but they all knew that the citizens had the rights. And to me, when you look at the Bill of Rights is not the rights for the state, not the rights for the government. It's the rights of the people, the Bill of Rights. And right. The very
first... Of the individual.
Of the individual, yes. And so the very first amendment for the Bill of Rights brings up freedom of religion, that the government will not establish a religion and that there will be freedom from that. And when Thomas Jefferson was in his first year as president, received a letter from a church, a small church, a minority denomination, and they expressed their concerns, this is where we get the term wall of separation. Jefferson wrote back to them and was encouraging them that they didn't have to worry. In this new country that had been built, there was a separation, a wall of separation between church and state. Now, of course, the religious right tries to say that that wall is only one way. That wall is only to keep government from interfering with religion, so that religion can do whatever they want. But a wall, by its very definition, stops any interaction, any flow, either way. And that's what Jefferson meant. Now, of course, the Supreme Court under Warren had said that it is increasingly difficult to keep an absolute line separating that they never should cross, because it's just going to happen that some things will cross, will influence, will have some sort of bleed through. But the Warren Court upheld so much of the First Amendment and keeping everything straight, keeping everything divided. And that's critical, because the Johnson Amendment, that is part of our tax code, is under incredible assault currently by the administration to strip out the Johnson Amendment. And the Johnson Amendment also helps solidify that churches not get involved in politics and keep that separation of church and state. So it's under assault right now. There's a war against the Johnson Amendment.
Yeah, one of the things the Johnson Amendment is, we'll again add to that. The Johnson Amendment actually precluded the ability for churches to publicly support public officials. There are loopholes for that, granted. And I do agree with you, there's some fuzzy lines between the separation of church and state. It is a wall that works both ways. But I was talking to Jim prior that we went on air, and I want to get your feedback on it real quick. Why is it that there are religious people that don't want a separation of church and state? Because the likelihood of their flavor of Christianity or belief system, whatever, is most likely than one not going to be implemented, because there is so many different types of diversities of beliefs. Now, again, I don't think that you can have 100% separation of church and state, only for the fact that we exist as human beings, we exist as society. There's going to be some things that are just going to be permeating between church and state. And I get that, right? I think that's understandable to some degree. But as you said, the implementation of a state-sanctioned religion, or the implementation of something that goes beyond what would be considered to be a non-establishment of religion. If they establish something as a religious identity for a state, and again, I'm talking about the state level, not so much the federal. Why is it that there is this agenda to attack the Johnson Amendment and to implement their ideology in government? Because one of the reasons I particularly left the Mormon Church was they did that exact same thing. They tried engaging on the whole, I think it was 2008, Proposition 8 for the gay marriage, and I just felt that was overstepping that line of separation of church and state.
Well, your basic question, why is it that they don't see that it's in their own best interests for maintaining a separation of church and state? Because the religious right has been pushing a lie and a myth, just like they're reimagining our history. They also have been peddling and pushing propaganda to the people in the pews that Christianity, and not just any Christianity, but the far-right Christianity, has the answers to all of the nation's ills. We heard a little bit of it after the Columbine shooting. How, well, you know, if prayer was allowed in school, we wouldn't be having shootings like this. And that's such a blanket and easy solution for people to want to believe in. What they don't understand is, for the people in the pews, that just like in the countries that they think are so terrible in the Middle East that are run by a religion, it is the same issue. Because the moderates and the more left-swinging in those countries in their denominations or variations in their belief systems are never the ones that have the say. It's always the extremists. And it's going to be no different with Christianity. We can see it right now with Mike Pence as vice president, with Betsy DeVos. Everyone's so shocked at Betsy DeVos's agenda that is damaging public schools so much. But that's what the religious right wants, because they're not religious schools. What the religious right wants is seven areas of the United States to be completely under religious control. Their ultimate kind of vision that they follow, that they think was the ideal of how to run a town, a city, a nation, is John Calvin's Geneva. When John Calvin, who was a reformer, was in control of Geneva, it was a dictatorship, a religious dictatorship. There were home checks to see if you were living according to how they understood biblically your home should be run. The man was in control, the woman was subordinate, church attendance was mandatory. There was no, you know, vices allowed, like gambling, singing. It was an incredible dictatorship, but it was based on Christianity. And this is what they looked to as the model of what it should have been like, what America should be like. Further than that, you have to look at why are they so driven to do this? Because they believe that in order for Jesus to come back, they have to deliver the United States as the bride of Christ and usher in the Jesus' second coming. And this is what is their true motivation. They really want Jesus to come back because to them, that's the ultimate. He'll come back in vengeance. And that's what they want, is to see the vengeful Jesus. The religious right tends to stick to the Old Testament, and in the New Testament, their favorite scriptures are Revelation, because they love a vengeful Jesus coming back. They don't love a gentle shepherd that's forgiving of sinners. They want the vengeful Jesus, and this is their ultimate.
In the eyes of their God, you know, we aren't all equal. You know, some of us are better than others, and God has his favorites, and he will, you know, damn the other ones to hell. And some of them, he just, you know, there's no point in even trying to reach them, you know.
Yes.
Hey, Jim, do you think that's a narcissistic approach that they have? Like this, again, I think it's the post-millennial type approach that we have to, like, facilitate this narrative that we have to make America such that it can usher in the second coming of Christ, like we have any control over that whatsoever. If Christ is coming back or not, I don't know why that'd be contingent upon anybody here making that happen or not. But do you think that's right. Kind of a narcissistic thing? Because I think it is for these hardcore religious evangelists. I think it's arrogance, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's very arrogant. But then again, you're asking somebody who thinks that every religion is arrogant. But in this case in particular, and in Calvinism and like the Dominionism and this new like a reformation of Christianity that was done. It's really dangerous because for those who don't know, they adhere to Mosaic law and not just the Ten Commandments. We're talking about Levitical law, Deuteronomy law. We're talking about stoning homosexuals, stoning adulteresses, with rape victims having to marry their attackers. It just and like Steve said, they want to fulfill the prophecy of the second coming, and they believe that certain things need to happen in order for them to usher in Armageddon, and they are very, very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, if you've talked about this before, about the establishment of Levitical law, right? I mean, can you kind of explain to people what that would imply if people brought back this hardcore Levitical type, I guess, legal system? I mean, it's so bizarre on so many levels of why anybody would even want this, but can you kind of explain to people what that would entail if that would ever happen?
Well,
for one, go ahead.
Go right ahead.
Well, I mean, for one, to myself, the most egregious act that would be allowed would be the enslavement of people from a different culture, the enslavement of people from your same culture. You just can't own their wife and children when you're done with them. Involuntary servitude to pay off your debts. And then you have the more serious ones where, like I said, stoning homosexuals, stoning adulteresses, stoning people who have sex out of marriage. In the Old Testament, in Levitical law, in the first five books, it is just a source of, it talks about wars in which people slaughter the men, keep the women and children as their own, sell them as sex slaves. And this is being permitted and commanded by God. It's it's sick. And these people, that is where they get their justification for many things that are implemented into our laws today that we are already suffering the consequences of because of the leeching of the religious right into our government. Do you want to talk a little bit about the current legislature that's been that we're currently seeing?
Well, it's hard to keep up. I mean, it's shock and awe every day.
I just mean like current things that we have to deal with like systemic issues that we deal with our government that are because of religious induction.
Well, our culture itself, you know, the whole war on Christmas, that's a timely one. There is no war on Christmas. Remember three decades ago, the religious right was so ticked because Christmas was so commercial. But now it's become a war for them to try and say, well, you know, those happy holidays and all this, you're just trying to strip, Christ from the whole mix. So they've gone full bore into it. It's a 180-degree turn from what they had a few decades ago before the religious right really got into it. When Roe v. Wade first happened, most pastors were positive. There are even quotes from priests saying that this is actually, that this, you know, might be a good thing. And it wasn't until the evangelical and Catholics came together and turned abortion into the nice shock and awe value to rally people around them when that really wasn't what was behind the formation, the true formation of the religious right. And I have a quote in my book from a gentleman who talks about, who's an evangelical, but not religious right. And he talks about what the real formation kind of gelled around, and that was the Bob Jones University, which is why the Johnson Amendment is so important. Bob Jones University taking advantage of the 501c3 codes and was not paying taxes, but they were discriminating against blacks or mixed marriages in particular. If there was a mixed marriage, they didn't want to even allow them to attend. And complaints went to court, and their tax-exempt status was going to be pulled. And that is what rallied people around and gelled the various kind of dispersed movements, you know, from Jerry Falwell and all of these different dispersed concepts and movements, all kind of gelled around the Bob Jones University and the Johnson Amendment and that. And that was their main argument. They hate that, and it has been there. They've been gunning for it. And abortion was just the nice thing that they could use. Abortion is what they used to get people in, to put pictures up, to really grab their hearts and twist this. The religious right is incredibly deceptive. So a lot of the legislation coming out, they will label it one thing, like religious liberty that has come out recently, the religious liberty that they're trying to push, which is actually just a license for discrimination.
Right. Yeah.
Were there some particular ones that you wanted to talk about?
No. I mean, actually, abortion was a really, really good one. Another thing I wanted to talk about was things like birth control not being covered by our current healthcare system.
Okay, well, a lot of people go, well, if you're against abortion, why wouldn't you want birth control? Because, you know, every time birth control is more accessible, easily accessible, abortion goes down. Well, it's because abortion isn't, in that case, their end goal. The end goal is what they call quiverful, where women are having babies. This is what they view women's real role is to have babies. They're to get married and have babies. And the Quiverful movement is the religious rites blueprint template of what a proper family should be. And the man has absolute control over the household. It doesn't matter how old the woman is. There is no family planning, because that is self-centered and denying God his dominion over your life and your family. I have in my book an interview with a lady named Vicki Garrison, who was a luminary in the Quiverful movement. She even wrote for the Quiverful magazines. She had very risky pregnancies towards the end. Believe it or not, even the reformer Martin Luther had said, well, if a woman dies in childbirth, she's at least fulfilling her God-given role. And that's Quiverful's entire idea for women. So they don't want birth control, because a woman's supposed to be pregnant, but she's supposed to be married and have a woman over her. So they really don't care. If you're going to get pregnant, then you're going to, by gosh, be having that baby, and you better just get married and have a man, you know, because women are seen as sexually voracious and sinful and tempting of men. And that is the whole idea. That's where you get so much of the attitude. So birth control, a lot of women don't understand that it wasn't until the 1970s that birth control was made legal and more accessible. Margaret Sanger had a court order out for her arrest because she was passing out information about birth control that was illegal. And it was under the postal codes that you could not send anything having to do with, planning and anything to do with planning the family, any of that, until the 1970s. And there was even an interesting story. Loretta Lynn, who's a country music legend, had a song about the pill, how, you know, she was going to have fun now that she had the pill. And her record producers put off releasing the song for years, because even in the 70s, that just was taboo. And this is the 1970s is when the religious right started really gearing up with the seven mountains of influence over the culture.
Right. Yeah. And I know myself, my education suffered, my public education, due to its influence, that it got from the Christian right. Like, for instance, sex education, the sex education was virtually non-existent, and they taught an abstinence only, sex education program, which, I mean, it doesn't work. And my school is also big on school prayer. There was not a problem with that, and I was Christian at the time, so of course I didn't see a problem with that. My history teacher taught about Moses. He taught about Noah. It was just something that is still being implemented, maybe not to the extreme that it was when I was in school, but luckily, you know, you were talking about the Bob Jones University. The entire reason that started was because these liberal universities were popping up, and they were releasing all of these new studies in the 20s, where people were actually starting to see that science, you know, is the most reliable method, you know, and religion just isn't that reliable. And so he started this, especially evolution. Evolution was the really big issue with that. And so he was teaching a no evolution, and Bob Jones, I believe you, correct me if I'm wrong, said something like, if we teach evolution to our kids, then we lose God, or something like that.
Yeah, they consider evolution and science in general as a competing god, because in the Ten Commandments, you're to throw away any other idols, any other worship of any other gods, and they consider science a competing god. And that's why we see the huge anti-science movement, even among, you know, what you would consider intelligent people. I've seen the children of GPS satellite engineers being flat earthers, and their parents are going, "Excuse me, this is my job."
But I also think it's a kind of commonality that people want to have. They want to have a common enemy, and evolution is a common enemy of many types of creationist narratives, because one, it's not an easy thing to understand for most people. I mean, a lot of people don't bother to really look into the sciences that much, especially evolution. And so they can get away with putting out this narrative against evolution because most people are never going to go out of their way to really check on it. It's just the way it is, right? And the people that do obviously know that the creationists are just fundamentally flawed and deceptive. But, you know, this goes to the whole narrative that you had mentioned before. You mentioned something about the seven mountain mandate, right? And one of the fundamental things of that is education, right? And I think that if they can instill this indoctrination, and I don't mean so much religious indoctrination, but creationism specifically, into the secular system, into the public school system, that's a huge part of that mandate that you were talking about, is it not? I mean, it's a gargantuan compared to, I mean, you have politics, don't get me wrong, but politics have always been divisive, right? And politics can only do so much. I think it starts in the school system. I think school system is where they're putting a majority of their time and effort, much more than politics. Now, I could be wrong on that, but from my personal perspective, because I deal a lot with evolution and a lot with dealing with young creationists and flat earth now, that I see that to be their primary push. What do you think is more the seven things, and you can go into each one, but what do you think is the primary one that they're focusing on, and which one do you think has the most influence?
Well, because the religious right is a diverse kind of loose conglomeration of movements. It's not highly structured. It's very loose with, you know, between the Mormon church, the Catholics, the evangelicals, and even within evangelicals, it spans the denominations. And so there are many, many groups, nonprofits out there that are attacking different parts of the mountain. So it's all at once. It's not like they're just focused on one at a time. And this is why it's so hard to combat them in some ways, because it is so all out encompassing, trying to attack every area of our culture and society. But yes, I believe education is one of the most important. And they see that children are our future. So if they can take a hold of a child's mind and in mass, they can change our future. Now, there are a couple of things to this. The Texas textbook issue, I don't know if you followed that, but that's just one part of it, because that's rewriting our history. It's also going into our social studies and everything that's taught in schools, pretty much. Creationism
They were voting on two different people. They're voting on Hillary Clinton and Moses, and whether or not to leave them in the Texas textbook. And they were they didn't want to put the first woman elected to Senate in a textbook, but they wanted to put Moses for somebody that scholars pretty much unanimously agree on, that the Exodus is described in Exodus never happened.
They wanted to also put Moses as a founding father for some strange reason. I'm not sure quite how that works. Moses was not a founding father. I don't know how you even if Moses existed, which I do agree the Exodus probably didn't happen, but how did they have a narrative that somehow Moses is now construed to be a founding father? That's just bizarre.
Because they believe that his law influenced America and the founding of America. So they believe that without Moses, that our founding fathers wouldn't have gotten their individual religions were.
AF, what were you going to say, AF? We have a little bit of lag, so well, I apologize.
I just wanted to go into a little bit. Again, Moses, they're taking the emphasis off of what Christ really taught. And I think when I talk to Christians who are may have found my book, the biggest thing that I stress is, you know, Christ came to give grace and good news. And he said that he was not doing away necessarily with the Old Testament, but he was fulfilling it with this new covenant that he was bringing to the people of grace and love and blessing from God the Father. And if you call yourself a Christian, then you are saying that you are following Christ. But what we see with the religious right is it is the modern day Pharisees. They are legalistic. They do not really follow Christ and his grace and his compassion towards fellow men and women. None of that. They've gone back to the Old Testament and Moses and all of that. And that's why Moses is so key, is because that's what they've really moved back to, is the time before Jesus, the time before grace came, and any compassion towards the fellow man, back to the Old Testament. They'll claim they're Christians. Go ahead.
I said that makes a lot of sense, actually, the way you put that. Is that why that they would bring back that Old Testament type narrative? Because, again, I am not an anti-theist. I'm not anti-religious at all. But I see a strange dichotomy between the Christ that I was introduced to years ago, you know, this more turn the other cheek, pacifism, you know, love your neighbor kind of stuff, which I think people in general have no issue with. There are even atheist Christians out there who don't subscribe to the divinity of Christ, but like the philosophy of Christianity, and I'm totally cool with that. But then I see the radical evangelical types that want to bring forth this narrative of a much more vindictive, a much more hostile, a much more aggressive, warlike Christ, right? And again, that's a huge difference in dichotomy. And so the people that I see that are friends of mine that are Christians, they're not into that type of position, right? And they are the more, what I would consider to be more modern or moderate, I guess would be a better word, moderate type Christians, which I don't think most people have any reason to really have a narrative against, right? I mean, that's their individual belief and that's what they want to live their life by. I'm okay with that. But this other type of evangelistic narrative, you're right. I do see them going back to the Old Testament type things. I mean, especially when they bring back, let's kill the gays, let's kill the non-believer. There's like, 30 different things that are death penalty things that people could die from. And yet people to this day, right now, are saying we need to bring back these death penalty things. And I'm like, are you out of your freaking minds, people? It's just bizarre to me that anybody in 2018, almost 2019, would even remotely want to bring back that type of theocracy. Go ahead, Jim.
I have to disagree with your model or interpretation of Jesus and most Christians' interpretation of Jesus. Jesus was not a kind person. Jesus did not preach love for his fellow man. He preached love for his fellow man in a tribal sense, in that if you were a part of his crew, then you would specifically in the Gospel of Mark, which is considered by biblical scholars to be the most reliable source of Jesus's life, a Canaanite woman came up to him and said, "My Lord, you know, my daughter's possessed by a demon, you know, come and help her." And she's just screaming, and Jesus is ignoring her and just keeps walking, just ignoring her, and the woman's throwing herself on the ground just in a fit, crying, just grabbing onto Jesus' feet and begging him, said, "Please, please, you know," it says like the Lamb of the House of Israel, you know, come help me. And he didn't. And he said that it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. That is what Jesus says in Mark.
I get that narrative from the Bible, right? I don't disagree with you on that. I'm just saying that there are people that want to take this more pleasant type of approach to Christianity. They do exist, whether I think that's the narrative put out in the Bible or not.
Well, of course they do. That's any kind of moderation. You see the same thing happening in Islam right now. You know, you see this reformation happening, but the reforming of the religion isn't taking away the fundamental beliefs, because they're still operating on the same doctrine and they're still using quotes from the same book that these other atrocities are written in, much less the same testament. So if they are really that concerned about modifying their religion to fit with a more modern sense of living and a more acceptable moral code, then they need to abandon their book completely and reassess what they believe in it and what they determine to be moral.
What do you think about it? Are you still with us? Because I'm getting a little bit weird.
I'm still with you. I've had a power outage.
Okay. Oh, I was going to say, you're like sitting in the dark. Oh, no. What happened there?
Yes, I'm sitting in the dark following you.
Are you on your phone? Is that why you got you're just on battery backup right now on your phone?
Yes.
Yes,
okay. I'm on my phone. So.
Well, let us know. I mean, if you have a power outage, we don't want to keep you too long if you're going to be like running out of juice. But do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, especially, I think Jim makes a good argument on that. If Christians today want to have influence, and I'm not talking about the evangelistic ones, but I'm talking about the ones that actually want to promote this more pleasant version, is there something to be said by abandoning some of the things in the Old Testament? Especially things like you have to get rid of young earth creationism. I'm sorry. You're never going to put that narrative out there. That's never going to work in society, not in a modern day society. It's wrong. It's just as wrong as flat earth. You're done. And this is what scares me. Somebody had mentioned in the live chat, if for some reason Trump went away and didn't take Pence with him, what would we have? We would have a young earth creationist president, which literally scares the shit out of me, to be honest with you. So, do you think there's something to be said that if Christians want to put forth a different platform altogether, they do need to somehow abandon some of their more older core principles and not be the Pharisees that you're referring to? Because I do see a lot of that overlap.
Well, what Christ taught, yes, there's still some of the old world harshness, because Christ was not without his influence of his time. And so you can't necessarily look at Christ without putting him in the context of the world that he was in. And it was a very harsh time. I mean, that's just very simply put. But I think if you want to truly follow Christ, believe it or not, one of my closest friends is a devout Christian, but he doesn't go to church. So he's not getting inundated with this, you must follow the pastor telling you who to vote for. You have to follow all of these edicts. To him, he's just trying to live his life day to day, following his Savior and doing the best that he can. And he knows where we differ, and he said, you know, all I know is that God told me to love my fellow man. So, you know, that you don't believe, and that you don't even believe in the Bible now, that's fine. I'm just going to love you as a friend.
Yeah, and well, I think that's great. I think people who can recognize the immorality of certain parts of the Bible, but still search for that sense of a deity or something like that, and be able to separate the two. There are some people who can't separate morality from religion. They accept the immorality as morality because they are so indoctrinated with the religion. But where I was going with that.
Well, yeah. Well, I'll touch on it. Let me run with it, because I do see that happening with some people in their communities that we deal with. There are some people that cannot separate morality from the belief, and so they have the most bizarre belief system when it comes to the imposition of morality. For example, we should kill the gays and things of that nature. It's like they somehow justify these atrocities and these atrocious ways of looking at a moral framework by saying, well, you know what, we're not going to be killing them. The government's going to be killing them, because the government is going to be from the leadership of Jesus or the leadership of some, vicar or whatever. So it's not us doing the dirty work. It's not us doing the immorality. But at the same time, it's like, wait a minute, you're passing the buck to somebody else, because I'm sorry. And I'm telling you straight out, if you have to go to a book for your moral sense of code, you have no morality to me. And I'm fine with people saying I have morals, right, because of beliefs and all that stuff. But as soon as you abdicate your responsibility for belief system, when I'm trying to put this in a way that doesn't sound too philosophical, but as soon as I abdicate my moral responsibility, when I say this is the way it should be, I don't want to live in a society like that, because if there's no possible way you can say it's justified to kill somebody because of their sexuality, to kill somebody because they've eaten shellfish, and to kill somebody because they've had mixed fabric. So I think it's a dangerous precedent to set when you start saying we need to have the government involved in this stuff. And that's why Jefferson, one of the things that they established was that wall of separation. So we don't have anything like that, because it scares the hell out of me. It really honestly does.
And one thing that's important is that even before the late 1700s, in the late 1700s, there was such a division amongst Christianity. And today there is so much more division. Over 200 years later, there's so much more division amongst religion, especially amongst Christianity sects. So if they do want to implement this, this theocracy, then they had to account for people like your friend, who I wouldn't consider him to be a Christian, because he doesn't he cherry picks, you know, he picks what he likes and what he doesn't like, and he takes what he likes, and that's how he lives his life, because he recognizes what is moral and what isn't moral, which is where I was trying to go earlier. So how can other Christians assist us in this, or how can we reach other Christians to assist us in this, to recognize the dangers of their own beliefs and their own religions being infringed upon?
Real quick, Dave, have we lost AF on her Skype, or is she still with us on audio?
She looks frozen.
Okay. Yeah. While she's reconnecting, that's fine. When you can try to reconnect with her. And while she's doing that, we can kind of touch on this a little bit. You know, I don't really have an issue with people picking and choosing for their own belief systems. I know that sounds weird, I really don't. If they could take the goodness out of something and see good. And by the way, if you live your life that, you know, you do, be good to your neighbors, don't be an asshole to people, that kind of stuff, I'm all good with that. Right. I mean, you take the best of belief systems, but
yeah,
the issue I have is that a lot of people, and again, we've seen this, we've seen it with a numerous amount of people in our own communities, that don't just take it as a belief system. They take it as such a absolute moral imperative that if for some reason we don't implement these stuff, there'll either be wraths put upon us. There'll be, you know, again, we won't usher in the second coming because if you're post-millennial. That's the kind of narrative that I'm very much against, because for one, I believe that if there is such a deity, that deity doesn't give a shit whether you are trying to implement these things into secular society, because God would know in going into, you know, the 2019 that we as a society don't really buy into a lot of this stuff any longer, right? God's going to know that there is going to be a separation of church and state, that promoting these types of belief system is not as easy as it was 2,000 years ago, because 2,000 years ago, again, they didn't know a lot of things that we knew, and they were more susceptible to say, this is God's will. You know what? I don't believe that anybody knows what God's will, if God exists, is, because I don't think he's communicated it very well. I think everybody's just fumbling along in the dark and going, this is what we think God's will is, but if that works for you, great, but you can't tell anybody else what God's will is, because I guarantee it, you probably have no freaking idea.
Absolutely, and that's kind of the point that I was trying to make, was that the idea of God exists on such a spectrum, and just the Abrahamic God, well, just the Christian God, it exists on such a huge spectrum that you can't put two Christians across from each other and have them discuss their fundamentals, not just the details, but just the fundamentals, and not disagree on at least one thing. So that I guess what I was asking is how can we How can we reach believers and have believers help us reverse what has already happened in our government by helping them realize that their beliefs are in danger too, that they're that infringements on what they consider to be moral or immoral are in danger too?
I think it's simple. One, you don't promote radicalism. Don't promote these people that are fringe and radical. The mainstream is where it's going to be at. I've never seen a fringe movement take hold to the point where they became the norm. If it does ever happen, we're in deep shit, because that's how it used to be thousands of years ago. We've shied away from that. I think a lot of people are more moderate. A lot of people are more mainstream than they put out, and they don't want to see any kind of extreme position to be the normative. And so when you have these radical evangelicals, call them out. Censor them. A few of them I won't even give a platform any longer to. right? I've reached out to many of them, and I know Kyle has, and Dave has, and a whole bunch of other people. We've reached out to even some most radical people out there. They end up biting us every time, every single time. And so these are the people that just don't need to be having a platform. I won't even allow them on my channel, some of them. I believe that sunlight is a great disinfectant for certain things, but other people that spew vitriol, other people that spew bigotry, other people that spew homophobia and that kind of crap, I have no interest in giving them a platform or anything like that. And I think that's pretty much how we go about a society. Shun those people that are radicalized like that, because the more exposure you give them, there is a potential for them to indoctrinate other people. Now, again, people can say, well, Steve, you guys have flat earth stuff. You know, that's fine. But you know what? I've never seen a flat earth discussion convert anybody to flat earth. Okay. It just,
What's he going to do? Push us off the ice wall? Come on. Like,
yeah, it's really not a concern of mine. Right. But I do see people that promote bigotry. They do seem to appeal to emotions. They appeal to people's sense of differences, right. And people's wanting to have their own sense of identity. And so they will pick out something that they can group on to and say, okay, we're going to isolate these people because of their race or their gender or their sexuality, whatever the narrative they want is, right? And that's been historically something that always been the case. If you want to have a group of people have cohesion, pick on somebody that they all dislike, unfortunately. Yeah. So welcome back, Abe. We missed you so much.
I don't know how we went out again. And
well, real quick, let Jim finish this little train of thought real quick, then we'll get right back to you, because we were kind of discussing on how to prevent some of the radicalization of America, and Jim wanted to do a final thought on that real quick. So, Jim, go ahead.
Well, I would say that there are a lot of people out there that hold these closeted beliefs, these closeted bigoted beliefs, or transphobia, homophobia, whatever, and the niche community that is the more outspoken community that you won't give a platform to. Those are a very small percentage of that community, a very small percentage. There are a lot of people out there who hold those beliefs that you would never know about unless you held them as well and discussed them in private with them. But by allowing people those platforms, you're emboldening them and giving them validation for their beliefs.
I totally agree. And now I'm not saying that I'm 100% against it for certain people. Again, if somebody is really good at exposing something and really good at shining a light on it, then fine, go for it. There are people that discuss Nazis, you know, on YouTube, and they're really good at showing the huge idiocy of this white supremacy narrative crap and all that stuff. And you know what? Go for it, right? I just don't have the skill set to do it because I'm not well versed in that side of these discussions, right? But if they can point out to people, you know, why you're a fucking idiot to be a Nazi, go for it, right? I have no issue with that, clearly. But I'm not going to have a Nazi come on and spew their agenda on this particular program. I know Kyle won't either, because that's not what we have no reason to give them a platform.
Yeah, and nobody's saying that they can't hold these beliefs. They are more than happy to hold them. But if you're in defense of these people operating their freedom of speech in this manner, then that's fine. I applaud you for defending somebody's, you know, freedom of speech. But if you're defending what they're saying, well, then that's a different story. I mean, well, why would you defend the inciting of violence and hate towards a group of people that is based on false claims?
Well, let me ask AF that, because that kind of does go back into the Seven Mountain thing. Do you think the people, obviously I'm not against I'm against censorship of freedom of speech. I'm not against people saying what they have a right to say. I don't care if they want to spew the most vitriolic crap. They're allowed to do it, unfortunately, right? I just don't have to give them a platform for it. But do you think that they have a right to interject when it comes to putting religion into, like, for example, well, you know what? One of the things is like the military. I was ex-military, right? And I'm fine with having a chaplain. I'm fine with people having faith things and things of that nature. However, one of the things that we had talked about before is having an atheist chaplain, right? And the military was really much against it, although they've had a few. What do you think when it comes to this freedom of speech, it should be applied equally, right? I mean, if you have the freedom from religion, you should have freedom of religion and back and forth. So do you agree that people should have a right to express themselves on any platform that they have access to? But, well, I'm just going to, you know, leave it with that. What do you think, Abe? Do you think that people should be limited in their speech? So I'm trying to pay attention to the live chat and have a conversation here. So please forgive me.
I mean, it is protected in our Constitution. And I think our forefathers were trying to be as forward thinking as possible. I know that they came across a lot of hate at the time, as I tried to say before. I think that they were intelligent men. But the platforms that we have now, Facebook and the societal media that we have now, where you can taunt people, you can haunt them online, you can make somebody's life a living hell under the auspices of free speech. I think we're going to have to define it better. Now we have, you know, the hate laws and hate crimes, and people, it's going to come to a head where somebody's going to say, yeah, but my freedom of speech versus a hate speech. And we're going to have to more clearly define it, because it is so much easier now to spread the hate. And a disturbing thing that I found out just recently is that it was a high percentage, I'm going to say 64%, maybe a little higher, of teenagers now in high school doing their research are taking it from alt-right and white supremacists websites for doing their homework and turning in assignments. And this is becoming more and more of a problem in the schools. So that the access with the internet and social media and all of this for them to spread their hate, and for the people who cannot tell that this is just hateful rhetoric, it is not truth. They're rewriting history, they're reinterpreting, they're not factual, and people are taking it as being facts. So that's one thing that I think is going to come to a head because of the hate speech versus free speech. We're going to have to really define.
I have to interject on that a little bit. Here's my position on the hate speech thing. I think hate speech is free. I think that people can have a right to spew bullshit. And I hate to say it, but you have to allow it. However, you don't have to allow it on Facebook. You don't have to allow it on Twitter. They can set their own mandates. They can set their own TOS, right? If they want to deplatform somebody, that's their prerogative, right? You don't have freedom of speech on somebody else's platform. You just don't. So if they think that somebody's being racist, it sucks, because of course we've had people that are actually anti-racist get deplatformed. We have people that just whatever they say is taken out of context. I get that. And like you said, it's be a fine line, and it's going to take some time for that pendulum to find its middle ground. But there's a difference between allowing hate speech and allowing hate speech on a platform, right? But if people want to stand outside the corner and spew hate speech, it's protected, in my opinion. And I know that I'm going to get a lot of flack for that. I really am. But
the only problem with that is what happens when you have when it turns from one crazy person preaching on a corner with the end is coming sign to a man on the corner preaching the end. The end is coming sign, and 200 people are listening to him, and 200 people are listening to what he says and taking it as truth, and he tells them to go and hurt somebody for a specific belief.
Well, that's different. That's different. No, that's not hate speech. You cannot advocate violence, right? There's a huge difference between hate speech, just by saying, you know what, I'm promoting this ethnocentric racist bullshit. That's not putting out violence. Now you start saying, hey, you know what, you need to hurt somebody because they're not of the same race or creed. That's not freedom right there. You've broken a law at that point, in my opinion, because you're advocating violence and inciting violence.
So what about not directly inciting or advocating, but inspiring?
Well, that's why you don't give them a platform, right? Again, a person on the corner inspiring violence is not inspiring. It's not going to be that taken that seriously. They're allowed to. And what you hope to God happens is that the rational people will stand up, and there'll be more of them than the people listening. That's what the goal is. And that historically, I think, has been the case. Well, you know what? But again, I'd rather take that chance than start limiting the potentiality for free speech. I'm sorry. When a government comes in and says you cannot say something, that to me is a worst possible scenario. I'm hoping that people as a whole are have common sense. I'm hoping people as a whole do not fall for this kind of stuff. And there's more of us than them kind of thing. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I think that the danger is far more egregious having these laws put in place, like, you know, like Canada, you can't say certain things. Germany, you can't say some certain things. And I understand the reasoning. I don't want to see that in America, though. I'm very pro-liberty. So, again, I'm going to get a lot of shit for this, I'm sure. And I'm sure going to have a lot of people
in the comment section going, in Germany, it's illegal for them to fly the Nazi flag, right?
I do understand the reasoning for that. I'm not against that.
But that's just freedom of expression. I mean, that's covered by the same constitution. We're not Germany. But you're saying that you understand that.
I do understand it, and I'm not against it for Germany, right? I mean, we're not Germany. I'm only speaking as an American, right? I'm only speaking as somebody who's fought for this country. This country is predicated on a different principle than other countries are predicated upon. And if we don't uphold that, then what do we stand for? By the way, I think we've gone down a completely different narrative than sorry about that. Yeah, but I mean, this is something I'm very passionate about. And like I said, I'm fully aware that I'm going to get a lot of feedback on this, a lot of shit probably. And I take it. I'm fine with that. I have my own opinions. I'm very expressful of them. And I'm hoping that the people that do agree with me, they might be far and few between, recognize the dangers of having a government come in America and start limiting this type of stuff. And it does go to the core of your book, if I'm not mistaken, mm-hmm. from what I have read on it. You don't seem to be advocating this position that we shouldn't have free speech. You're just showing the dangers of these things from, like, it was Gary North, Bonson, Rushdoony. Thank you. What a name.
Rushdoony.
Do you want to go into that real quick? You want to talk about that side of your book, if you don't mind? Because I find that fascinating, to be honest with you.
R.J. Rushdoony wrote probably about 1,000 pages worth of, I forget the title of it now, but he essentially rewrote American history. This is where we're getting a lot of how the U.S. is based on Christianity now, was from R.J. Rushdoony's writings. He was the biggest one to get homeschooling legalized for everyone because, of course, the public schools weren't religious indoctrination and they were teaching kids to have higher thought processes and question things, and that was just not acceptable. You're to accept the Bible and that's it. So there, ergo, yank your good Christian, kids out of public schools so that they will be taught to be obedient and only. And that's grown from there. So Rushdoony laid a lot of the foundation work for what then took place in the 1970s with Youth with a Mission, the leader of Youth with a Mission and Campus Crusade. So you've got Youth with a Mission goes into a lot of high schools. So they're very active with high schoolers. Campus Crusade is big in colleges. And the two of them came together and came up with the Seven Mountains Mandate. Of course, they're going to tell you that they each had a glorious vision of this. And then they discovered that the other had the same vision. They try to include Dr. Francis Schaeffer as being part of that. You'll hear them always talking about he also had this vision, but his son Frank Schaeffer has completely denied that and said that's crap. But they came up with the Seven Mountains that essentially takes Rushdoony's foundation work and puts it on steroids. It is the blueprint for how to take over a culture. Seven main areas that are divvied up constitute any nation's entire society and culture. And if you become the prime influencer in those areas, then you have control over the nation. And the beauty of this, as far as just straight, you know, talking about the strategy, is they have been doing this for the long term since the 1970s. High schoolers and college students from then to now. That's why so many corporations you have are give major money to the evangelical and religious right causes. This is why, you know, we have so many politicians now who are religious right. The biggest thing that they're told is, whatever business you go into, whatever you want to be, you have to do it for God, and you have to claim that area, that business, that whatever, for God. And you promote other religious right extremists, it's like a sorority or fraternity. You're looking for the others that are just like you, and you're raising them up. And the business is a big part of it, because that helps fund, because these big business CEOs and presidents are funding, channeling money and funding the other parts of it. So it is a takeover. But one of the things that I really want to emphasize that I don't think I touched on earlier, when you said, why don't people understand how it will be different if it's a theocracy? The biggest thing that Americans don't understand is the Bible, as a ruling entity over the country, does not ask for your opinion. There is no voting, because the Bible is unchanging and, quote, inerrant in their view. There are no errors in it, and there is no changing it. God's word is God's word. And this is where you lose all your rights. To me, this is
and your marbles.
Biggest point.
Jim, Jim is kind of laughing at this and your marbles. He said, Jim's kind of laughing at this. Jim
actually has a book. All your rights and your marbles.
Jim, don't you have a very, don't you have a book on this topic, Jim, for this very
thing? Yeah, I do. Yeah, it's coming out next week, guys.
Yeah, it's kind of I'm vaguely recalling that you have a specialty in this area of biblical contradictions.
So,
and inerrancy.
Right.
Right. Well, and it's not just textual either. We're talking about moral contradictions, like things that contradict our altruistic code as humans. Things like witchcraft and heresy and blasphemy. Like, those are things like executable by death, having sex. I mean, losing your virginity before marriage. I mean,
I would have been executed hundreds of times over by now. Then, but
you've been executed for witchcraft for that Gandalf beard thing you got going on.
Oh, I was into witchcraft back when I was in high school. I mean, I wasn't like a practicing witch, but okay. I mean, I had a friend who was a witch. I was really into.
And now you're a false prophet. I thought so that's really another.
Because I love Black Sabbath, right? I mean, Black Sabbath was my all-time favorite group. Well, that Metallica and Rush, but I mean, Ozzy and Dio. I mean, come on. I mean, the day I died, brother. So yeah, I mean, I would have been killed for that. That would have been heresy to listen to Ronnie James Dio, I'm sure. But hey, what were you going to say on that?
Well, to me, it's not even a matter of something big and splashy like, oh, you're a Wiccan or you're an atheist. It's just the mere fact that you're a citizen of this country, but because you're not somehow living up to a finely defined view of what a full citizen should be under a Christian regime, then you are not a full citizen. You have no rights. And this is how they also interpret the First Amendment, that the whole idea of citizens' rights. The religious right will say that that's only for Christians, that was never intended for anyone other than Christians. Oh, and by the way, they have a very, you know, as I think you mentioned before, they have a very specific and narrow definition of what counts as a Christian. The Military Religious Freedom Foundation, most of the people that they defend are Christians who are being persecuted in the military because they are not radical Christians. So they're not Christian as far as the religious right is concerned. So they have got to bring them in line. And I also bring up one of the seven mountains that of influence is religion. And that's not for something like Muslims. That's for the, quote, Christian churches. There are Methodist churches in the United States who have been waging battles with the religious right, trying to take over their hierarchy of their leadership so that they can start dictating for the Methodist Church more extremist views for all the churches. So the idea that, so what if it's, you know, Christians have more control over the government? Well, it's not a democracy, and that means you don't really have rights. Because if it really is reconstructed the way that they want, to where the entire Constitution is built on the Bible, you will have no vote. There will be no vote in this mm-hmm. country. Look at the Old Testament. Look at the New Testament. Did God ever set up a democracy? No. He doesn't care about your voting on what he says. God is the ultimate, and he will say what is to be. And that's where they want to go. That is literally, it is a dictatorship, and it is no different than Sharia law. It's just Christianity instead of, you know, Islamic law.
I don't think that it's reaching or unfair to say this, but I believe that most believers, most adherents to Christianity are naive or gullible by nature. And I think that it would be it would be really easy for them to influence their votes to vote for them. Because now, I mean, look at it. They voted for Trump because Trump claimed to be a Christian. Trump claimed to be, you know, the best defender of Christianity. But we're talking about somebody who won't, you know, say the Apostles' Creed at a funeral. With them just blindly following these people who claim to be religious, they can just literally implement any kind of law that they want. I think the three of us know, but I think most people know that if you want justification for something that you do, you can find it in the Bible. If you're seeking justification, you'll find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's something to be said
for
that.
Yes, there are many interpretations. That's why there are so many denominations.
So what happens, though?
Most Christians inherently depend on another Christian to tell them what they believe. That's why they go to church. They go to church to hear the top 40 hits and to tell them, you know, what they believe. So their idea of their current idea of what is Christian and what isn't Christian for the majority populace of Christians, it comes from somebody else telling them, you know, what how to interpret this or how to interpret that, or it's already been cross-referenced and the, you know, the paper's already been written that's convincing enough argument to bring them over to their side. So if they want to implement something the religious right, they, under the guise of Christianity, they can, whether or not somebody actually believes that or not, just because they use the label Christian.
Yeah, that's true. They go to their pastor and they go to the other people for their guidance. That's what I say. The Bible is interpreted. The people that that follow a specific belief system, none of them have discovered any of that belief on their own. They've always gotten it through other sources for the most part, right? These things are not things that we can go out and experiment with. These are not things that we can find evidentially. These are not things we can find empirically. And again, I'm not into those things. I'm not an empiricist per se. I'm a rationalist. I don't hold evidentialism. So I totally get that. But when you have to rely on other people to tell you what something means, unless it's talking about something you can go validate yourself. Like if somebody says, "Hey, Steven, philosophy, this means this, or math just means this," later on, I can actually go validate this, right? I don't have to just accept in the face value. There's no way to do that when it comes to biblical beliefs. And so what would happen when somebody says, well, okay, this is some historical stuff, but what would happen when if we did implement, and I'm going to say state by state, because that would be more likely the scenario. Let's say a state could have a state sanction, and I mean literally state as the states, not as the country, their own interpretation of religion, this Sharia law, Mormonism, Jehovah's Witness, whatever they want to implement for their religion. What happens to the other Christians of that some other denomination? I mean, to me, that would be more divisive than having a state that just has like an atheist thing where this says, you know what, we have no belief. We don't believe there's gods. We don't care what you believe, but we're not going to have any encroachment between religion and state. That to me would be the narrative that I think that any rational religious person should take, because then they're free to worship any way they want. Because as soon as you have somebody tell you that you're worshiping wrong and that the way you're interpreting the Bible is wrong, there's going to be more discord and more fractioning than any other possibility, I think. Would you agree with that, AF?
Actually, we can see that in history. In history, you know, in the Middle Ages and so forth, you had the church wielding great power over the local rulers. So you could have any local ruler, if he disagreed with the church would turn around and use spiritual blackmail and tell all of the villagers and all of the people under this king or whatever that, you know what, you're not getting last rites anymore. You'll all go to hell. Because exactly. Your ruler has, and it is spiritual blackmail, flat out. That's happens. Unless you follow this particular denomination's view in this state, then you can't get business licenses. You can't. You probably won't get medical care priority, any number of things, because you're not, you know, one of the you're not falling in line, and. That's how it will be.
They would blackmail entire cities. They would say that the entire city cannot have salvation. They would not have last rites. They cannot pray. They cannot commune. They cannot do anything relating to the church. So they, if you didn't fall in line, it wasn't like an individual person. They would say, well, you're being excommunicated. They would take entire cities. And back then, that was like the greatest threat. Because they believe very strongly in this eternal damnation and this hellfire, and of course people get scared of that kind of stuff. That's why I believe that it was implemented and it works. I may not be a religious person, and I am, people know, the Pope of Agnosticism, but I don't believe in this burning hell. It just makes no sense to me. If there's an afterlife, great, but that's not it. That I will say I believe very strongly does not exist. Right.
Well, so, there's no biblical evidence for hell.
Yeah, no,
we saw
whatsoever.
This when George W. Bush was president, because the evangelical pastors of the day, to counter any criticism against the president, would say that, you know, if you criticize the president, you'll go to hell.
Yeah.
So I have no fear of hell.
And people say, well, Steve say, I love this. People like, Steve doesn't like the use of the word atheist because he's afraid of hell or if there's a possibility. I'm like, no, I'm not. I will tell you right now, I have no fear of this burning hell kind of thing. I think it's complete bullshit. Do I think there might be something afterwards? Possibly. But that's not it. So that's not this reason why I don't take that type of nomenclature, right? It's definitely not for fear, because I'm screwed either way, right? I don't believe in God. So if there is such a thing as hell, I'm fucked. No matter what. So to not take the label makes no difference to me, right? So I think that's kind of a weird narrative when I hear people say that. Well, Steve's just kind of playing the Pascal wager thing, I guess, or something. I'm like, no, that's just absurd. I'll tell you right now, I don't believe in hell. So, and I believe this was a fear tactic that was brought on much later on, that was never really in a biblical type perspective. So
I believe in Gehenna and the Valley of Hinnom.
Yeah, Sheol. It was Sheol, the Valley of the Dead, and that kind of stuff. That was in the Bible stuff, but that wasn't
narrative. Sheol just means grave. That's all that means. Sheol is grave, and whenever they are referring to Gehenna, which is what they're using for the interpretation of hell, it's that Gehenna is the Valley of Hinnom in Judea, where the ancient Judean gods, or I'm sorry, the ancient Judean kings. Would have child sacrifices, and they would burn their children there in the Valley of Hinnom, and in Jeremiah, God curses it. What's that?
Yeah. Well, it probably smelled like death and hellfire and brimstone and all this other stuff.
So years after that, they would keep it. They kept it burning. It was still a burning place, but they would burn people who had been executed. They would burn trash, anything like that. It was a perpetual fire that kept going that never went out, so they could burn their fire. And that's where the criminals' bodies went. So when Jesus was saying that, going to Gehenna. Being a criminal and being executed and thrown into a fire.
I completely agree with that, actually. Yep. AF, do you want to add anything on that? I mean, we're kind of a little all over the place here. I hope you don't mind. This is kind of what happens.
Yeah, sorry. That's kind of my thing.
I'm going to change the subject just a little bit. For those people who wonder why I wrote the book and you know, why they should listen to me, I was actually religious right. I was in a religious right church for a number of years. I taught Sunday school. I taught kids, you know, the you know, very strict, you know, walk the line for years. I taught the pastor's son even. So I came out of it because of an abusive marriage, and the pastor literally did not believe in, you know, letting the marriage go, divorce or anything, because, you know, whatever God has put together, let no man put asunder. No matter how abusive it was, that didn't matter, you know, him and the pastor and the elders were supposed to take care of it all. And after an event where my ex tried to kill me with a loaded 357 Magnum, and it was only because I just sensed that everything was falling apart, I would not walk back into the house without the pastor with me. And he had taken pills. It was going to be a murder-suicide. So I was late waiting for the pastor. And so by the time we got there, he had started to pass out. The gun was there waiting for me. And that entire thing where the pastor did not believe that my life was important enough over, you know, the quote covenant of marriage, that's when I started to break with the extremist church. And I started to notice as I researched that it was extremist. I thought that was Christianity. That's what I understood Christianity was. So I had to break with, that is not the God that I want anything to do with if he doesn't care about my life. And so I ended up writing the book as I realized that people don't understand that it is not democracy that they're talking about. There was one sermon where the pastor actually said, you know, the biggest problem that people in America have in understanding the sovereignty of God is because of democracy. You think that what you, your opinion matters. And
wow.
The people in the past who had kings who were sovereign, who could take your life in an instant because they were sovereign, they understood the concept of a sovereign God. And
that's a hell of an eye opener right there.
They understood the concept of divine justification.
Yes. So that is what we're talking about with the religious right, is a sovereignty that doesn't care about who you think should be leading, who, you know, what laws you agree with or don't. That's why my book is called The Greatest Threat to Democracy, because there will be no voting, no democracy. It is flat out, this is our interpretation of the Bible, and that's what rules.
You know, when you said something about them not putting the individual safety ahead of the belief, I mean, that stands out. Look at anybody who's in that kind of relationship, anybody that's in an abusive relationship, anybody who thinks that marital rape is not a thing. I can't not tell you, get out of these types of relationships. They're going to end up bad. I mean, there's no possible way anybody could have justified to me that a religious belief should take precedence over an individual's safety. It's just, you're never going to convince me of that. And when I see people, and again, certain people I will not platform for this very reason, but some of them actually advocate, you cannot have marital rape. And I'm like, do they not understand that being married doesn't give you sovereignty over somebody else of that nature? If so, you know, and so there's this narrative and it goes back to the whole, and I hate to use this word patriarchal, but in this place, I guess it does apply to the biblical passage where the man is the lord of the manor. When he says go, there is no safe for the woman, right? And I can see why the evangelicals put forth that narrative as a power play going to this power structure. And again, I'm sounding like you know, the typical SJ person, and I'm not, but unfortunately, this is true. I mean, this is reality. But it goes to that seven mountain thing. People want the empowerment for each of these types of things. It's not just for religion, by the way. I've looked at your seven, the seven mountain thing. That's not just for religion. that could be any ideology, any whatsoever. Yeah.
Yes. And what may be an eye-opener for some is that, you know, way back in 2007, when we were going through the debates for the upcoming presidential election, and it was Obama and McCain, the very first debate that that Obama and McCain had. Do you remember where that was, where they held the first debate?
I don't remember, but I remember the question that you're referencing.
It was at Saddleback Church, Rick Warren's church in California.
Rick Warren. Yes.
It's a violation of the First Amendment that they even had the first debate there. But Saddleback Mountain Church, or Saddleback Church, sorry, had on their website at the time of that debate exactly what I went through, that divorce, even in the case of abuse, was not allowed. And I think I'm losing my battery on my phone.
All right, well, we'll start wrapping this up. But yeah, I do remember that. Saddleback Church is actually not typically my area right now, but I mean, it's California. I mean, people, where's it at? Lake Forest? I don't remember, but it's not that far from where I'm actually at. And yes, there are these mega churches out there. And yeah, how did they have it in that type of mega church? I don't remember the details,
well,
but I do remember vaguely exactly what
you're talking
about.
Influence. That's the religious right influence.
Not the Baptist
right
church,
there.
Right?
They that's a fundamental Baptist on their church. They had a question on faith.
Wow.
Yeah, and they tried to apologize for it, saying that it was the only place in the area that could accommodate for seating.
I'm from Orange County, so I mean, I take that very personally, because I know there's a lot of places down there that you can have large. You go to Anaheim Convention Center; they can host something like that.
But yep.
Anyways, let's wrap this up a little bit. I know your battery's dying. I'm going to read out the super chats real quick, in case there's any questions for you. How long do you think you have on your battery? Yeah. 5 minutes?
I just went and plugged it in, so I'm sitting with my charger now.
All right. Well, we're still at we're over the 90-minute mark, so we're going to wrap it up anyway. So let me get some of these super chats out there. Then, Jim, any final thoughts you might have, and then AF. So Morton Jewell says, for 17DDK, thanks. You're welcome, Morton. We appreciate you guys watching. And I want to put a special shout-out to James Freeman, who put a little blurb on his channel to send people over. He's the First Amendment auditor that we're going to be having on again. We had on a few weeks ago. I'm just glad he's not in jail. He's had a lot of legal issues. And I really love his channel. If you guys not checked out James Freeman and News Now Houston and News Now Dallas and those guys, go check them out, because I can't get enough of watching their stuff. Steve Brownman, $3 for Steve's gambling addiction. I haven't gambled in a decade, although I do like playing Texas Hold'em. So if anybody wants to play some Texas Hold'em, I'll play. NZ Pure, I think. I think it's NZ Pure, $2. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. Thank you. But Jim, why don't you go ahead and give us your final thoughts, and then we'll wrap it up with AF, and she can plug her stuff and kind of bring this to a close, because I got to tell you, this was great. This was very educational, to say the least. And I'm thrilled when we have somebody come on like yourself to come in and talk about these things. It's just a far cry from the flat earth crap that I have to deal with. So I love these things so much more.
Yeah.
But Jim, go ahead.
First, I just want to tell you, I enjoyed your book. I know I told you before the call, but I read it about 2 years ago. But for anybody who's wanting to get a little bit deeper look into who the religious right are and what tactics that they're using and who they're connected to, and it's very, very comprehensive. And I mean, it's a really good book. Just check it out. But I was just wanting to ask you who would you say that your book is geared to? Who's your audience, and who needs to check it out?
I was trying to reach anybody who looks at what's happening, whether they're in a church or not, and says, you know, this is crazy making. You know, where do these people get all of this? How can they be for this and yet against that? How can they? Because it seems so confusing. And and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, scratching their heads. And so I'm trying to show and explain and expose that there really is an agenda. It really is coordinated to some degree, and there is reasoning behind all of this, and you need to understand the reasoning. So I love it when I hear Christians reading it, and I got one review on Amazon where the guy said, actually, this has been more affirming to my Christianity than it tearing it down, because it's brought me back to what I believe is a true message to be, you know, faithful to Christ, and a message of love thy neighbor instead of, you know, the hate that's being spouted so much. I have a testimonial for the book from a gentleman, Jason Childs, who read it and did an early release, read it and did an endorsement for it. And he's a former Liberty University graduate who got out of the event. He was a pastor, too. He was an evangelical pastor. And he stressed that it is an important book to understand what's really going on and to know how to combat it. So many people just get upset at what seems to be contradictory. Like I said, you know, oh, well, if you're against abortion, you'd be for birth control. Why are they against birth control? Why are they against teaching sex ed in schools? Well, you have to understand, and that's why I did the book, was anyone who's questioning, anyone who wants to understand what the heck's going on, wants to understand why Betsy DeVos has devoted her life to tearing down public schools. Yeah. That's because of education.
I got to tell you,
I've got to tell you, because I'm still not a fan of Betsy. I mean,
oh,
I don't.
What the,
I'm appalled that she's in position. Right. She's in the position she's in. Oh yeah, it scares the hell out of me. She's incompetent for her. I mean, why? How the hell did she get that position? It's just nonsensical to me, to say the least. But it does go to show that we are putting people in positions in this particular political environment that should not be in the positions that are in. Matter of fact, I would say that pretty much most of them are in positions that should be there. And the ones that were competent got the fuck out. People are quitting left and right, and there are reasons for that.
Well, Pence and Betsy Ross and several other appointments were to pay back the religious right for them delivering 81% of the evangelical vote.
Right. But what's really sad is that the average American voted in all of these people. Your average American, so the majority of the population reflects these people's, belief systems or their leanings. And I think the most important thing is educating our fellow citizens into researching the candidates, researching the platforms, researching why they believe what they believe. And that's the biggest thing, is not believing something because somebody tells you, believing something because you have your own personal justifications that have met your own personal standards of evidence.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more than that. I think people need to start believing things that they personally can go validate or they can check into. Don't rely on other people. Look, none of us are going to tell people what to believe and what not to believe. We don't have the right to do that. We can give you information. I can spend a lot of time telling you where to find information. I know we have two brilliant people here that can do exactly the same thing, but I'm never going to tell a person what to think or how to think. That's what they have to do for themselves. But once you start relying on other people on where to get information that you can't find anywhere else, for example, hey, how do I exegete this? How is the proper way to understand this, theology? Unless it's some kind of historical thing or some kind of, linguistic thing or whatever, when you're just going by a pure theological belief, nobody can tell you these things, right? Because nobody freaking knows. I do believe that. But anyways, AF, thank you so much for this. This was wonderful. This was a little late than usual, but you were a fabulous guest.
I appreciate you doing that for me.
But the book is in the video description. Go check it out, please. Go buy it. And with that, I'm kind of going to leave you guys with a little reflection. Well, you know what? I'm going to actually let you have last word, Jim, because you were nice enough to come in last minute, by the way, to do this and to substitute for Kyle, who is snowed in. Kyle is fine. He's on vacation. But you want to plug your Atheist Republic, and I'm going to let you give a little word of wisdom if you like.
Sure. Well, first of all, Steve, thank you for having me. I really, really enjoyed being on here. Anytime you need a co-host, I'm more than happy to accommodate. I'm Jim Majors. I'm CEO of Atheist Republic, atheistrepublic.com. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter. We have consulates in your area. If you want to meet up with local atheists, check us out. We have consulate lists on the website. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you guys. Thank you all for listening. Good night.
Bye.
Non sequitur, your facts are uncoordinated.